Welcome to the RL Life Podcast, where we speak to top business and thought leaders from around the world. This episode is a replay of one of our live business insight sessions tackling the hottest and most pressing trends with leading industry experts. Be part of this conversation as it happens with RL Life. Visit rllife.com to learn more. Gain early access to various insight sessions and join over 8,000 leading business executives from top 500 companies in Europe to build meaningful professional relationships and hear from renowned experts all year long. Visit rllife.com to apply for membership today.
So what are we going to talk about? We are going to talk about, let's say, to start off on a date, the 9th of December in 2023. That was more or less an historical day because after a 38-hour negotiation, it was the EU Parliament, the Council and the Commission engaged, showing an unwavering commitment to finding the delicate balance that serves the general European interest when it comes to AI. In other words, the AI Act was born. And that's what we're going to talk about. What does it matter to you? In this session, we're going to unpack this AI Act. Well, I'm guessing that we're not about to unpack it as a whole, because then I think we need more than 38 hours than for, let's say, to unpack it as a whole. But we're trying to give you the key highlights and the key things you should know. And I'm happy to do that with one of the experts in this theme. His name is Walter Pascarelli, and he is a globally recognized expert on generative AI strategy. He advises many, many big corporates around the world. He has been quoted and published in many, many different international media. And he is absolutely an expert who can talk with us, with me, but also with you on the EU AI Act. Hi, Walter. Nice to have you here. How are you?
Hi, everyone. Really nice to meet you and really good to see you here again. How's it going?
I'm very good. Thank you. Like I said, we only have about, let's say, 40 minutes, not 38 hours, to unpack the EU AI Act. Would it be enough, you think?
I think like in 40 minutes, we can absolutely cover the basics and create a foundational understanding of what piece of legislation we're dealing here, actually. When it comes to, I think, fully unpacking it, that takes a little bit longer than 38 hours, I would say. But we're here today, and I look forward to covering this topic in as much detail as we can.
Great. As an expert, as an AI addict, I must say, have you been following this whole trajectory to this AI Act and also this 38 hours of negotiation? Were you involved? Were you seeing it?
Yeah, I've been following it extensively over the past few years, and it's been a bit of an emotional roller coaster, let's say. When we started out with sort of like the conversation about an EU AI Act, I mean, that was, I think, long before the actual launch of sort of like the generative AI tools such as ChatGPT. So we actually focused on a very different kind of understanding of artificial intelligence. And so some have argued that this used to be more of a approach towards products, but since there has been the launch of these kinds of tools that have really transformed our understanding of the possibilities of what's actually out there, that meant as well that the UAI needed some updating as well. And so whilst we were there just about to finish it up, updating needed to happen. And I just remember in the final 38 hours, I mean, I looked at my Twitter feed, and the amount of information that was coming out from the trilogue was just incredible. But I'm glad that now we made it to the point where we are right now.
Great. Just to make sure that everybody is on the same page, can you briefly explain what the EU AI Act actually is? What are the main, let's say, pillars or components?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if we think about the EU AI Act, let's view it as the world's first comprehensive regulation that seeks to regulate how AI can be used in European markets and in the European bloc. At its heart, there is basically four pillars that this EU AI Act has, and that basically creates four risk buckets of where different kinds of AI applications can fall. So we have on the lowest bottom, like applications that have basically a very low risk, which will face basically almost no regulatory action. There is medium risk applications, there is high risk applications, and then there's so-called prohibited risks at the very top. So essentially what the EU AI Act does is that it looks at the AI ecosystem in Europe, it categorizes it into these four buckets, and based on that, different kinds of companies that develop tools will face various kinds of regulatory actions. Happy to go into more detail about each kind of risk buckets, but that's essentially what the EU AI Act is. So think about four categories of risk and that and the resulting regulation this has on products.
Yeah. And you already said it a bit, you know, it is usually legislation in the EU takes, let's say, years, 10 years, 5 to 10, perhaps 15 years, especially in this particular topic. I can imagine that it was the 9th of December in 2023, but I can imagine that it was already on the 10th of December kind of lagging behind, right? How does this involvement came in the end through this final EU Act? Because like you said, it's a topic with so fast developments and so fast changes as well.
Yeah, and I think that's precisely why the approach of the European Union is so broad. So that's why the European Union has basically produced these four risk buckets, because that allows for a relatively wide net that we can cast on AI products, which I think is a little bit different from other countries, which we can elaborate in a moment. When it comes to AI development, I always say 1 year is not in AI years is like passes up like this. So if we look at, for example, the developments that happen within the artificial intelligence ecosystem, the kinds of technical possibilities that are out there, I mean, in 2 years, the whole environment has changed. We're now able to produce video generators that look almost hyper-realistic. We now have tools that can create entire marketing copies instead of in weeks, in hours. And I think that is just going to advance faster and faster. For legislation and for regulation, that of course means that there is a need to adapt and there is a need to be able to create regulation that is not going to be outdated in a year or two, as soon as there's going to be the new, basically a new technological update. Can the European Union AI Act achieve this? I think that sort of its broad approach of sort of casting a wide net positions it well. Certainly, it will need more updates as soon as sort of new kinds of technological breakthroughs will happen throughout the years.
Yeah. And what about the involvement of, let's say, experts? Because what always you hear often from, let's say, entrepreneurs or businesses, well, legislation is made by people who are not, let's say, really into the topic or are not practically involved. How do you see the involvement of experts and people who know what AI actually is in this whole process to come to the AI Act?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the million-dollar question, right? how can you involve experts in the development of these kinds of legislation so that you don't just have policymakers that just like develop regulation and are like, well, here you go, guys. I think particularly in the field of artificial intelligence, even harder, because the skills of AI skills, if we want, there's still in quite a lot of scarcity. And as a matter of fact, the people with technical understanding and technical skills typically go more into the private sector rather than in government because of issues such as payment benefits and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
When it comes to the involvement of experts, typically what regulators and legislators in the particular case of the AI Act did is that there are so-called stakeholder consultations in which there might be sort of a wide kind of like a call for contributions and a call for opinions where people are technically able to provide their opinions on whether they think that the EU AI Act is actually suitable. There has been quite a bit of criticism, however, in the sense that typically the only organizations that were able to provide actual feedback have been the large conglomerates. So organizations that were actually able to, first of all, have the necessary bandwidth, the necessary resources to be able to formulate their policy positions and understand them. But for smaller startups, smaller companies, this is something where there has been quite a bit of criticisms that not sufficient experts from that ecosystem have been involved in drafting appropriate policy.
Yeah. And when it comes, we do have a question coming. We have many questions coming in. Thanks for that. But one of this, it's also reflecting on this, like you said, the path through the end date of the EU AI Act, the classification of generative AI. There was a version of this AI classifying it as a high risk application. Is that still true? Indeed, there was a, let's say, the act was already presented in 21, but yeah. Then let's say in the 2 years after, the world has been changed 100 times. did this reflect on the classification of AI in general by the EU?
Yeah. So generative AI is probably one of the most exciting areas of AI development at the moment. excuse me, simply because of the ability of these kinds of tools to not only provide outputs in terms of sort of like statistical probabilities, but also really like generate outputs that are accessible for us as humans. Think of, for example, text, video is getting increasingly big, images. When we think about generative AI and risk, the debate centers around one simple term, and that's open source versus closed source. If we look at a lot of these sort of like models that have been developed, there are some firms that say, we want to make sure that these models are open source and accessible to everyone, so that basically these models can be used for creating innovations and spreading it out, democratizing it if we want. Some other firms are saying, well, this is problematic because then these models can then be used to give me the instruction to develop a weapon or something harmful or create an output that is potentially upsetting. So what is the alternative? And some other firms here, some of the other technology firms and some regulators say we should make them closed source. So basically not that everyone can use an adapt this model, but we should provide it through a readily made interface that has inbuilt limitations as to what you can ask it to produce so that you cannot use it to develop something crazy or something that is harmful towards others.
Yeah.
So in that sense, if we come back to the question of whether that's the right categorization, I think if we look at, for example, open source models that anyone can use to develop anything, possibly the high risk element is not unjustified. It would make sense just to be able to ensure that the outputs are actually safe. If we look at closed source models, the risk is still high because you can always circumvent some of these security barriers that are put in place. But I think that we will see over time that that these security barriers will become stronger and more waterproof as these models progress and as we will go through a process of trial and error.
Yeah. What's your personal stance in this? Do you consider it as a high risk, or do you consider it, like you said, if you can't beat it, just join it?
Now you're putting me on the spot for Jeroen. So my view is, if we have models that are fully open source, there is probably a very high element of risk there, simply because anyone can use them for something.
Yeah.
I think there were on the internet, some on GitHub, some people that were developing basically like autonomous AI agents as a joke called Chaos GPT, which has sort of as a known goal to sort of produce harm. And while that's not sufficiently advanced because it's not good enough technologically, I think that's precisely the wider issue that it highlights, that harm can be created. So I think putting them out there, just publishing it, I think is quite risky. And I would probably not advocate it to do it without the right kinds of regulatory provisions.
Yeah.
Closed source versus semi-closed is probably a little bit safer.
Yeah. You said the scope of the AI Act is very broad because of this ever-changing developments in the world of AI, but still there is a question coming in. Does it really point out some particular things? Like, for example, the question is, are there clearly stated requirements from AI Act towards, for example, the EU Anti-Money Laundering Act? You know what I mean? Does it point out some particular things when it comes to security or fraud or corruption or whatever? Or is it broad that it should fit everything in?
Yeah, I mean, to provide some context before I go into the answer, the reason why it's so broad is, on the one hand, because the EU AI Act doesn't seek to regulate AI products per se. It seeks to regulate the risk. And in doing that, it acknowledges the fact that developing European legislation takes ages. And so the only way to be able to tackle this is by producing something that is relatively broad. Different from China, which is very fast in creating regulations, which is more of what they call a horizontal approach. So there's this technology that's developed, and within a few months, you have a new regulation coming in. They can do it because they have a different kinds of legislative process. Now, when we look at specific provisions, for example, on anti-laundering and sort of like, I guess it brings up a question, what is, how do we categorize these kind of risks? So what does something that is high risk mean? What is something that is medium risk mean? What are the specifics on there? The UAI does provide a list. I believe it's in an annex, but I would need to double check that, of sort of certain kinds of applications that are considered to be high risk. Think of, for example, using artificial intelligence tools for determining the credit worthiness of an individual, right?
Yeah.
Highly controversial. Think of artificial intelligence tools used by the police, which typically have shown elements of bias. And if we look at, for example, issues such as money laundering, that's going to be probably a similar one. But I think the European Union will provide some descriptions of what these applications are. A lot of it will be judged by case law over the upcoming years. And keep in mind, there's going to be also like an adaption period where organizations will have to be able to consult with the European Union on that.
Yeah.
If I can give one piece of advice to organizations that are out there is the AI Pact, which is something that the European Union has launched, which is voluntary and basically has organizations that can join in. And that provides as well an avenue for obtaining additional information, at least on a surface level, as to how it's going to impact your business specifically.
Yeah, you already touched upon it. Let's move a little bit on the global scope. Is this EU Act a new stage on a global scope? In other words, is the EU now a front runner when it comes to legislation on AI, for example, compared to the US and China? You already mentioned it. What do you think?
Yes. And put simply, because it's the main comprehensive regulation that is out there. So, I mean, China is very fast in regulation, in regulating these tools, predominantly for their own internal domestic reasons, such as political agenda, economic prerogatives, but also like simply the fact that they want to be able to compete internationally at the geopolitical stage. And AI is such an important element of their strategy. Europe has produced the biggest overarching legislation. It's a fact of life. It's there. It's not going to change. But it's something with which countries, both within the European Union, companies within the European Union, as well as those outside that want to do business with European companies, have to come to terms with. So the UAI Act is a fact of life. It's there. And it's going to influence companies in the EU, but also companies outside of the EU, which is something called the Brussels effect. Hmm. America, though, the United States, as I should say, came up a few months ago with their own US executive order on AI. And they've kind of been like tooting the horns and hitting the drums that this is going to be the most sweeping act of legislation or
like,
policy that it is.
Like they do usually in the United States,
like
right?
They usually do, exactly. It's not. Okay. It's not. It's an executive order. And that means that it's basically an instruction by the president to different kinds of agencies to develop standards and regulations, but it doesn't provide anything. It has no bite. There's nothing out there yet that we can really judge as to saying, is this stringent? Is this not? We know there's guidelines. We don't know what these guidelines are. It's going to come in the next couple of years.
Yeah.
I think actually within the next year. But there's nothing quite out there yet.
Yeah. And let's put this more to more practical impact for, let's say, businesses in Europe. For example, a question from Christian. He says, currently the EU has a big disadvantage in new technology, mainly because lack of fundings. Now there is the EI Act. Will this become an advantage? Having this AI, will this also impact, for example, funding in Europe positively, for example, compared to the US and to China again? What do you think?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. Hugely controversial, by the way. So I think that when I think about legislation and regulation, the questions that I always ask myself is for whom?
Yeah.
America, the United States, was usually sees like artificial intelligence and in general the tech sector as a point of strategic advantage worldwide. So that's why their legislation is laxer, because it allows for wider experimentation on technology firms without having to be worried that the regulator is going to come and hit them based on that. There's all sorts of advantages, such as higher risk potential, higher risk appetite. But there's also disadvantages in the sense that a lot of things can go wrong, especially for consumers. The European Union, on the other hand, they said we want to put consumer protection front and center. There is an advantage in having these kinds of regulations there in the sense that produce predictability and legal certainty. So I know that if I want to invest in a company, I know what to expect in terms of whether there is a risk that regulators might come in a few years and say, hey, this is actually quite risky, so you cannot continue your company further. But the other thing to consider is whether there is a direct link between regulation and venture capital. European investors have been much more like reluctant to invest similar amounts of funds that, for example, their American equivalents have. And whether the European Union AI Act will have a positive or negative effect on that, that's perhaps a little bit early to say, but I think there's probably other elements that have an impact on that, such as, for example, the potential of startups to be able to scale, to be able to become the European tech giants, the Google or Meta made in Europe, right? Legislation can support, it can harm it, but I think there's probably other elements on there that might have an impact on the VC funding.
Before we hear more insights from our esteemed guests, I'd like to remind you that this podcast is brought to you by the Aural Life Business Network, the exclusive community for Europe's leading CXOs. Exchange ideas with your peers, gain insights from top industry experts, and connect with executives who truly understand your unique challenges. Aural Life is where CXOs like you make valuable connections. Visit aurallife.com to learn more.
Yeah, but still legislation, and you're already mentioning it, and I can imagine that you hear that also in your daily practice as well with all the conversations you have with many big companies. Legislation actually is a bit like, it fears people sometimes, you know, again, legislation where we have to comply with, again, something where we have to take into account. How do you see this? Because I can imagine we hear rather positive story on the EU Act, Europe is becoming a front runner. It is a good development, but then on the other hand, in daily practice, it is again legislation. And well, it can also have the perception and in companies that it will be blocking and will be even more, cause more difficulties in developing and innovating, etc. in the field of AI. What's your take on that when it comes to legislation?
I do think you're right. And there's been quite a lot of pushbacks from firms that this is going to basically, I mean, the arguments are two. One is that it's going to slow down innovation because there's less room for experimentation. The other thing is that we're trying to regulate a technology that hasn't even fully matured yet. And I think that's also the challenge of regulating AI, because it needs an evolutionary regulatory framework, because the technology develops and it changes. It's not like we're regulating nuclear energy, which is still high risk and high stakes, but nuclear energy today is going to be probably not much different like nuclear energy in 10 years, right? Different for AI. There is probably a counter argument that can be made there, in the sense that if we compare it, for example, to other regions which have fully fragmented policy environments with different kinds of data governance regimes, with different kinds of legislations between countries, the EU AI, even though it might be a little bit more stringent, what it can do is that it harmonizes legislation across countries. If you look at the United States, say data protection, it's basically done at state level, right? Mm-hmm. California which has the home of all tech firms, has something that is very similar to the European Union. But if you look at other places like, I don't know, Texas or Alabama or any of these other states, it's actually a very different story. So there's probably a harmonization element there that can be considered beneficial as well.
You were talking about the worries of companies in this whole development of this AI Act. And of course, when we talk about Brussels, we talk about lobbying. Do you have any overview on the impact of lobbying? In other words, for example, Mark has a question on that. Are there controversial topics that have been heavily influenced or reduced by lobby groups, which we could expect future legislation by the EU because these topics are now not adequately addressed? In other words, what's the impact? What has been the impact of lobbying?
So if you might remember that at the final stages of the EU AI Act development, there were a few countries, notably Germany, Italy, and France, that were like, no, we're not quite sure about this. We might actually like tear it apart. This is not the kind of legislation that we think is right for our markets. From what I know, that was a direct impact of sort of like lobbying from companies to be able to say, no, don't do this.
Yeah.
And especially apart from Brussels itself, which I think has the second biggest lobby in the world, Germany, France, and Italy are in Europe the largest ones. So that, from what I know, has been a direct result of that. But at the end of the day, they still stuck with it. So you could argue how successful that has been. I know there's a lot of, among some of the larger technology firms, there is not a lot of positive thinking around the EU AI Act. So that would imply to me that the lobbying efforts, which have been enormous, there's been millions going into that, haven't been particularly successful, you could say. There might have been certain provisions, minor ones that have been influenced, but I think that surprisingly, most of the efforts of the European Commission to fend lobbyists off have been relatively waterproof from what I've seen. Lobbyism, nonetheless, and sort of the public relations and public policy between the tech sector and the EU Commission is important, though, because there are still like a lot of provisions and a lot of interactions that needs to happen so that the legislation matches the requirements of the sector. So, yeah. Lobbying is a bit of a dirty word. Still needs to happen, just so that there is a harmonization process happening.
Yeah. Clear. There are also many questions coming in more on we talked about the legislation part and the way companies have to deal with that, but also when it comes to governance, you know, this is the EU Act, and how is the governance organized? In other words, some questions, for example, from Dirk Habenicht said, having EU Data Act, Digital Service, AI Act, etc., how to get EU AI solutions in line, fitting all to them. Do we need a new authority, for example? I believe Christian it is talking about data. How does the AI Act make sure the data of AI applications are not taken from forbidden sources? In other words, who's still monitoring and governing all this?
That's like the hitting the Achilles heel, I think, of the EU AI Act, and that's an excellent question, Dirk. So thank you for asking this. So the European Union made a few, had a few learning experiences, to put it
in a very diplomatic way, I would say, right?
Yeah, well, I'm in the UK, so that. With their data protection officers, particularly with the General Data Protection Regulation, so GDPR. And the point is that this used to be sort of a national effort whereby you would have these kinds of DPOs, as they were called, that would enforce the regulations the pan-European legislation on a national level. The problem there is, and as I alluded earlier, is that these are scales that are usually quite a lot in scarcity. So you might have this big regulation, this sort of meaty, huge overarching framework, but it's very difficult to implement it because these national DPOs might actually used to face shortages of skills on that front. With the EU AI Act, there's now going to be a pan-European one that is going to basically widen out and spread it out on the level of the European Union itself. So it looks like the EU has tried to make some effort there and learning from these experiences. It's still incredibly difficult. For example, DG Connect, which was, I think, the Directorate General that was responsible for implementing the EU, for developing the EU AI Act. My understanding from the sources that I have is even they themselves have actually shortages of the right kinds of AI skills. And that means that implementation is going to be quite difficult. Yeah. So if we have this centralized European AI office, that's, I think, possibly the better approach. The lack of skills and the shortages and scarcity of the people who know how to implement that and enforce it at both the pan-European and the national level, that is going to be the make or break for the EU AI Act. because otherwise it means you might have a wonderful piece of legislation.
Yeah.
Irrespective of whether I'm for or against it, it's like you have this legislation that is there and it's a fact of life, but you can't properly enforce it.
No.
So that's an excellent question.
Yeah. Thanks, Dirk and others, because the governance and monitoring people are wondering. And that maybe it relates also to my following question, because let's dive into a little bit more, if you're okay with that, on some more practical examples on how to deal with it, actually, because we have the EU Act. It's roughly 3 months ago that it has been born, actually. But then I hear many companies and many business leaders who are listening or watching right now say, okay, I'm more or less working already with AI, trying to implement. The one is further than the other. But now this AI Act comes in. Do you have some practical examples for companies, for our audience, how to deal with it and how to, well, also stay ahead? Because this is, of course, very competitive and always changing.
Yeah, I would say to any company looking at it is go and join the AI Pact. That's the first thing. It's just like a voluntary association that you can be in, and that helps you basically have a forum of exchange and a source of information directly. I know some people are really reluctant about it because they don't like the EU AI Act. But my advice is it doesn't really matter whether you like it or not. It's there, and it's not going to change. Okay, so embrace the idea. It's there. You have to accept it. So have a look at the AI Pact. That's good. Another thing to consider is then doing, for example, a scan of existing AI tools and products, looking at issues, for example, what kinds of data do you use, who's your target audience for that, how have the models been trained, and that helps you basically do a relatively easy assessment of where your company's AI products actually fall within those kinds of risk buckets. Very unlikely that any of the people and the audiences that are present here today will have prohibited risks. I think it's.
I hope not. And please, if so, please join the chat to share those with us. But
I would love to know the stories. Like so, but there could be some that, for example, work in more sensitive areas such as healthcare, where you'd have to be a little bit more mindful. Or insurance, for example, is another one where you have to be a little bit more careful how this data is handled. How the data is shared and the kinds of applications that you actually develop. So join the AI Pact, do a scan of your of your products and where they fall, and then you will have an adjustment period where you'll be able to put in place the right kinds of regulations and the right kinds of provisions. So it's not going to happen overnight. It doesn't mean that the AI now is coming to force, and now if you're just waiting for the regulator to catch you, there's an adjustment period.
Yeah, and maybe a related question that just comes up, I think, because we're discussing this. What if you are active on a global level, for example, a multinational or just a company who is active in both Europe, the US, China? How to deal with all those different levels and content as well when it comes to legislation?
Yeah, so it depends the strategy that you would prioritize. If you want to be safe and sure that basically you're not infringing onto any regulations, stick with the European Union AI Act as sort of your general regulatory yardstick, and you'll be pretty safe across any geography. Simply because the AI Act has sort of the strictest interpretation of AI products. It's a little bit more difficult if you come from the United States. Where there is a very different kind of understanding of how data should be used and what is actually ethical or not. So when I sort of like speak with clients in America, or for example in last month I was in Italy, they're all for GDPR. The people in the US, they're like, no, absolutely, we don't want to deal with that. So easier if you go from Europe to the US or Europe to other geographies such as, I don't know, the Middle East or the UAE or these kinds of areas. Harder if you go from the US to the European Union, because that means you really have to adapt. But put simply, when in doubt, stick with the AI Act, and that should usually keep you pretty safe.
Yeah. Okay. So it's like prioritizing but still keep a global scope. Do not focus only on the one or another. I've also a question coming in from Dirk again, and it has many thumbs up. So it seems an important question, at least from the audience. Dirk asks, we have seen already vulnerabilities, sorry for the pronunciation, within AI-driven solutions implemented. Shouldn't there be a kind of OWASP, like recommendations for AI-driven solutions to avoid these new kind of risks? I just read it out loud, but I hope you...
Yeah, could you read that again? I'm reflecting on that. So I think I would need to know a little bit more what kinds of vulnerabilities are meant. I presume Dirk means, and I'm speculating here, there is either a risk of, say, bias of AI tools, unintended consequences, or say the risk of foundation models that they start going crazy and just producing stuff that it, like hallucinations, as they call it. So on that, I think, yeah, there's a lot of vulnerabilities on that. And I think there's going to be even more probably in one, some that are intrinsic to AI systems, some others that are intrinsic to their output. So what they actually produce. I do think that the UAI Act seeks to address the majority of those. There's going to be new kinds of vulnerabilities that will come out. And there's, for example, a number of other issues that are not fully addressed yet that will be a result of AI tools. Some of you might have seen this new tool that was released last week called Sora. Mm-hmm. That is basically a video generator produced by OpenAI. And there's a bunch of others that are currently in development from Stability AI, Midjourney, Runway. The UAI doesn't fully address the risk of disinformation from these tools. They do talk about a lot about sort of like disclosing some of the whether a piece of content is authentic or not. And there's sort of been some initiatives, but there's a lot that still needs to be developed there. And there, I think the United States has been more proactive on that, predominantly because of the upcoming U.S. elections of this
yeah.
year.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a need for that to be to focus on that. Yeah. Just to also have a look at the future. For now, what do you think? What are the key one or two things we need to watch? What are the key future developments from your end? From in your opinion?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great question. I would say there's probably two main things that I would look out for. One is the general improvement of the performance of these models. So think about systems that become smarter in making calculations, systems that produce better and more accurate text, systems that are able to produce some analysis based on some of the data that you have in a very comprehensive way. And basically producing better video content and so on. So I think basically an improvement of performance of these systems, that's one thing. The other thing, and that's something that we really saw last year, is how we interact with these tools. And I'm saying this because now a lot of people use tools like Bard or ChatGPT or designers who use Midjourney or some others who in data analysis who use Julius.ai. So there's like... there's an interaction, an interactivity element taking place. And to me, that means as well that we can not only reduce progress in artificial intelligence in terms of its performance, but also in terms of the seamlessness of the communications that we're going to have. If we look at all these systems that are put out there, there is one term that to me summarizes the future of these, and that's agents. So that means agents that you're able to interact with, that you have integrated in your AirPods, in your devices, and it's going to be easier and easier to give instructions to be serviced based on your need. Book me a ticket to London tomorrow for between 3 and 4 p.m. And these tools do it in an interactive way. Something happens in your schedules, they do it automatically. Conduct an analysis of this particular kind of data set that I have. And it produces that. So there is these two fronts, the performance, but also the interactivity element of what I think will be AI agents. So watch that space.
And that's interesting because I assume that we are going to see this faster than we expect.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Right.
A year ago, I would have said 5 years. Now I'm more like two.
Yeah. It's very difficult to predict into also in a specific time frame. We have been talking about this now roughly not 38 hours, but roughly 38 minutes now. Still, I can imagine people have a lot of information now, also inspired, have a bit of a glimpse of what the EUI Act actually is and what the impact actually is. And then my question always is to make it as concrete as possible. Listening to this, after hearing your story, hearing your insights, what should I start with by tomorrow? What should I do different by tomorrow?
The first thing that I would say is if I would be a startup or any kinds of organization that is working in the field, is have a look at the AI Act. It's surprisingly accessible to read. So it's not a super dense legislative, it's a dense legislative piece, but it's surprisingly accessible. So have a look at what sort of like the UAI Act itself. The other thing is to be aware of risks of your own products. So you want to understand exactly what are sort of like some of the issues based on the UAI Act that my products actually face. Mm. That's the immediate point to start. So you want to know what's actually happening out there. So read the piece of legislation, reflect on your products, and I guarantee you that compliance with the UAI will be something that's achievable.
Wow, that sounds rather positive and a real clear, concrete advice to start off with tomorrow. Thank you very much for now, Walter Pasquarelli.